Iran warns of retaliation in the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of its Revolutionary Guards chief. Where are we most vulnerable? That story and more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown of the Texas Standard Newsroom. As security officials take steps to fortify the U.S. against expected retaliation from Iran, how Texas may, to some degree, insulate the rest of the U.S. in at least one form of potential retaliation. Also, the Lone Star State, a longtime leader in the resettlement of refugees, is that about to come to an end? Texas's governor faces a deadline. All those stories and more when the national news show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on the 6th day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Well, I guess it's all anyone's really talking about, of course, the possibility of escalating conflict between the U.S. and Iran, hyperbolically spinning out of control. Signs of a certain hysteria are in place. Searches for World War III trending for a while there. Misinformation about the draft, which does not exist in the U.S., at least not yet. And inquiries to the Selective Service becoming so intense for a time that officials had to beg online visitors to back off as they tried to keep their servers from crashing. And as lawmakers returned to Washington this week for what was supposed to be the start of the next chapter in the impeachment proceedings, the New York Times reports Iran uncertainty grips Congress as politicians on both sides figure out how to run to their instinctive corners amid the dynamics of the assassination of a man reviled in the U.S. for his role in the deaths of at least 600 Americans, that according to the U.S. Defense Department in 2018. The two biggest developments on Sunday, at least on the face of things, appear grim indeed. First, Iraq's parliament voting to oust U.S. forces, though the asterisks here are that the vote was both non-binding and many members of parliament not present. The second development has asterisks, too. Iran announcing it would end its 2015 commitment limiting its uranium enrichment program, but oddly enough, saying it would continue to allow international nuclear inspectors to do their work, suggesting the nuclear deal may not be fully dead just yet. All of which leaves us where? Truly closer to conflagration? William Inboden is executive director of the Clements Center for National Security at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. Professor Inboden, welcome back to the Texas Standard. Good to see you, sir.
Good to be with you, David.
Let's talk about what I think is on the minds of most of our listeners right now, and that is, where are we vulnerable? Now, I know as someone who has consulted with the White House in many years past, how do you see our vulnerabilities right now? Because Iran has said it's going to retaliate.
Yeah. I think there's three crises we have right now, David. The first one is the security crisis, which is the immediate vulnerability of potential Iranian retaliatory strikes against Americans or American interests. And those could take any number of forms. But then you also have the diplomatic crisis of the broken U.S.-Iraq relationship and the other diplomatic crisis of the crumbling, let's say, nuclear agreement with Iran. And so all three of those have their vulnerabilities. The most immediate one, of course, is possible Iranian retaliation.
When we talk about a possible Iranian retaliation, it would be quite a large step indeed for Iran to try to attack the U.S. on its own turf, right?
It would, although there was the plot they had a few years ago to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. at a popular restaurant there. So that's the only recent time we're aware of Iran potentially doing kinetic action on U.S. turf.
Am I correct? Wasn't Soleimani responsible for that plot to take out the Saudi ambassador as well?
Yeah, Soleimani was behind that one. I mean, as much as, you know, I think the Trump administration has mishandled some aspects of this, shed no tears for Soleimani. He was a very wicked man. I mean, he had the blood of hundreds of American soldiers, thousands of Syrian citizens on his hands, and a number of others. So he was, you know, one of the world's foremost international terrorists.
All right, well, let's talk about then the diplomatic danger that you're warning of. How do you see that breaking down?
So there's again, two crises right now. There's with the Iranian nuclear deal and then with the U.S.-Iraq relationship. The U.S.-Iraq relationship, the concern is that if U.S. troops do get pulled out, that then creates room for the Shia militias to strengthen their hand with the Iraqi government and start targeting Iraqi Sunnis. If they start targeting Iraqi Sunnis, then you likely have a resurgence of ISIS, and we'd be back where we were in 2011. So there's a very real concern there. Then, of course, with the Iran nuclear deal, well, you know, we know how that is. If they do reinstall centrifuges, start enriching uranium again, break out of the agreement, then there's all sorts of bad ramifications.
Wasn't there. The predicate, though, for the United States withdrawing from that agreement the assumption that Iran is already violating the terms of that agreement?
I've not seen the intelligence, but I think there's pretty good evidence that Iran already was violating it, some at the margins, and maybe even more so. The inspections regime with the deal is very weak. That's why I didn't support the deal when it was originally concluded. So we're still not sure where that is going to go. But again, if it does turn out that they are openly, brazenly going into a breakout cycle on uranium enrichment, then maybe you have the return of possible Israeli military action against them. So there are multiple chess games going on right now in the region.
I think something that a lot of people have been, well, I think politicians have been a little bit afraid to weigh in directly on is the wag the dog aspect of a lot of this. Do you smell that happening here? We are now in an election year.
You know, I was working in Washington, D.C. in Congress in 1998 when the Clinton impeachment was going on. And then there, of course, we did the retaliatory strikes against Sudan over al-Qaeda presence there. And that's when the first wag the dog scenario came up. I don't see any evidence for that.
You don't believe that that's what's happening?
No, I don't see anything.
Then what's behind the timing of this attack?
I think the timing is just that we were seeing escalating Iranian actions against the U.S. presence in Iraq. Remember when they did the rocket attack on our base outside Kirkuk, and then when they fomented the protesters to storm our embassy. I think that's what it was. It's pretty straightforward. As Trump had, you know, not taken any strong military actions against Iran up to this point. He didn't retaliate last year when they shot down our drone. He didn't retaliate last year when they attacked the Abqaiq refinery in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And I think he decided, okay, now I need to take a stronger action.
On balance, is it worth that risk?
I support the action to take out Soleimani, as I'll say that, but I'm very worried that the Trump administration doesn't have the capability or willingness to do the very complicated diplomacy to put the pieces back together. So that's my worry.
William N. Bowden is executive director of the Clement Center for National Security, University of Texas at Austin. He also is a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. Professor, good to see you again. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Many Texans may not realize it, but when it comes to the resettlement of refugees, the Lone Star State's been one of the top states for some time, a leader, in fact. But that could be about to change. The U.S. State Department has given governors until January 21st to notify them of whether their states will remain in the refugee resettlement program. And Governor Greg Abbott is being awfully quiet about what he plans to do as that clock ticks down. Lomi Creel has been writing about this for the Houston Chronicle, where she reports on immigration. Lomi, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What's your sense of what Governor Abbott is going to do? I know he, back in 2016, sued the federal government, apparently trying to stop the resettlement of Syrian refugees. Is that a hint as to how he might be leaning come this new deadline?
Yeah, we don't really know because the governor has not responded to questions and has been pretty silent about this issue. But we do know, as you said, that in 2016, he led the opposition against trying to resettle Syrian refugees in Texas, and in 2017 withdrew from the federal resettlement program, which was really largely symbolic because what happened as a result is that the federal government just contracted with local resettlement agencies rather than going through the state.
Tell us a little bit about this resettlement rule that apparently was, what, created by the Trump administration in the past? Refugees could be resettled, wherever? Or how did that work?
Yeah, this is a new executive order that the president imposed in September, and it requires states and local governments to consent in writing before refugees can be resettled there, which is really unprecedented because in the past, the federal government would, working with refugee agencies, would just resettle refugees sort of wherever made sense.
Is that change the result of pressure that Texas had brought to bear on Washington?
I think that this is something that the Trump administration sort of has been thinking about for a while, and it comes after there has been some blowback in some states and areas about resettling refugees there. But I wouldn't say, you know, this is the result of Texas's opposition. And what we have seen as a result actually is somewhat surprising because at last count, 39 states, including 13 Republican governors, have signed on to resettling refugees, including states that consistently are very much supporters of the Trump administration.
But if the idea is to prevent refugees from coming to your state, there's nothing to stop, I would imagine, say, a refugee being resettled in Louisiana and crossing the Texas border the next day, right? I mean,
exactly. The government can't stop refugees from moving where they want to move. But what this executive order does do is it just prevents resettlement agencies from initially placing refugees there and then having that follow-up support to kind of help them integrate. So, but the end result, yes, the refugees can eventually move wherever they want to go.
Right, so what's the upshot of this? Let's say that Governor Abbott does, in fact, as some people have imagined, decide to opt out on this new rule. What does that mean for Texas? What does that mean for refugees?
Well, it would be significant. Texas has led the nation consistently in resettling refugees here. So there's very large infrastructure in terms of resettlement agencies and kind of job opportunities and integration help. So all of that, those agencies wouldn't have the funding to help refugees settle here. And so all of that would disappear. Though, of course, as we said, refugees settled wherever could still come here, but they would be doing it on their own.
Lomi Creel is an immigration reporter for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Lomi, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Monitoring social media on this Monday, let's keep the alliteration going. Here's Michael Marks. Michael, what are you seeing out there?
Well, I will admit, David, that after dropping out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination last week, didn't think Julian Castro would have his name back in the news so quickly, but here we are. Shortly before we went to air, for the former mayor of San Antonio and Housing and Urban Development Secretary endorsed Senator Elizabeth Warren for president, tweeted out his support in a video of the two having tea and discussing the 2020 race.
Discussing the vice president. I didn't say, no, I didn't say
well,
anything.
Well, this news did little to tamp down the speculation that Warren might name Castro as her running mate. Nick in San Antonio jumping on that. She says, Warren Castro ticket, please, I'm on board. But Scott Shepard in Saxe makes an interesting point about the Veep chances. He tweets in part that this could hurt Castro's shot because it impairs his relationship with the eventual nominee if it is not Warren. Lots of political intrigue.
Yeah, I'll say. Hey, there's some intrigue in the sports world, too. Dallas Cowboys apparently have come up with a new head coach.
Is that right?
Just a few hours after. We'll probably be exploring this a little bit later.
Maybe
in the broadcast.
So.
Send us your social media comments to Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, one of 17 U.S. universities with a land grant, sea grant, and space grant designation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Nationally, crime rates have been dropping, but in Texas, some spikes in homicides, assaults, and robberies reported, what statisticians refer to as violent crime. The latest numbers show a 6% rise in violent crime in San Antonio and in Houston. But in Dallas, the numbers are considerably worse, a 15% increase in violent crime compared to 2018. Murders alone up more than 27%. The Dallas Police Department came out last week with a plan to bring those numbers down, but as KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson wants to see a plan considerably more ambitious.
The police plan calls for reductions of violent crime and robberies by 10% in certain parts of the city and an overall violent crime reduction rate of 5%. That's not good enough, according to a written statement from Mayor Eric Johnson, who wants more ambitious goals. For example, he said the city should strive to reduce homicides, aggravated assaults, and robberies to 2018 levels. And eventually, he wants violent crime rates back to historic city lows of 2013 and 2014. Johnson talked about wanting a crime reduction plan during his State of the City conversation just last month. That's because overall crime was up 4% in 2019, and murders spiked 15%.
It's of concern. It's a significant concern. We've had enough African Americans killed in this city this past year to constitute an entire year's worth of homicide, regardless of race, for our city or for another major city.
The new police plan calls for taking a more data-driven approach to crime and improving communication among those in different departments, as well as outside organizations that work with police. Johnson says he wants details on how these strategies would be implemented and metrics for measuring the outcomes. The Dallas City Council Public Safety Committee gets the police department plan on January 13th. In Dallas, I'm Bill Zeeble for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We kicked off the big broadcast today exploring possible vulnerabilities to Iran in the wake of the drone strike assassination of Iran's Revolutionary Guards leader. But it turns out that there's at least one place where the U.S. won't be quite as vulnerable to Iran than it has been in the past, and that may be in large part thanks to Texas. Matt Smith joins us every other Monday. He's Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back. Good to talk with you, sir.
You too, David.
I know you've been quite busy tracking what's been happening on the oil markets. If Iran wants to strike back, and we suspect that it will, Iran has lots of potential arrows in its quiver, but I would guess that one threat that used to hang over the U.S. has been somewhat neutralized thanks to the Permian Basin.
Yes and no. So the situation is very much fluid at the moment, but the very real concern, and perhaps the base expectation here, is that we see some type of retaliation from Iran, and that hitting the oil patch, not in the US, but in the Middle East. So this could come in the form of attacks on US military bases or energy infrastructure in the region, but it could also be in the form of something else completely unexpected. Iran, after all, is fighting a number of proxy wars across the Middle East region, unfortunately.
Well, so when you say unexpected, I'm waiting for that other shoe to drop. How is it that we aren't better insulated against, say, massive fluctuations in oil prices or in supply in particular? I mean, that's where the U.S. was historically most vulnerable when OPEC would cut off supplies.
Well, yes, but it's the case a rising tide raises all boats. And so as the U.S. becomes more connected to the global market, and as it has done historically as well, when you see fluctuations in the global price and the global benchmarks, you see WTI moving as well. And so
that's West Texas Intermediate we're talking about there.
Yes, the U.S. benchmark, yes. So as we see a risk premium priced into global benchmarks, we see a rally happening as well for WTI.
All right, so let's imagine a worst-case scenario here. If I understand what you're saying here, we're going to see prices rising on that West Texas Intermediate crude. If that happens, that's going to be, I would imagine, at least in the short term, good for oil production, maybe bad for consumers if we see prices rise at the pumps, right?
Yes, you're correct. We'll see commodity prices from crude to the pump rising across the board there. The one thing that is interesting this time around, though, in contrast to what we saw in September when there was the Iranian attacks on those Saudi facilities, mm-hmm. we saw prices immediately spike for crude and then they came off again because the worst case scenario wasn't realized and we saw supply coming back to the market. This time around, we're seeing this risk premium being worked into prices. And so we're seeing a steady rise, and we'll see that coming through at the pump as well, simply because of this growing expectation of some type of retaliation from Iran.
So let's say that Iran decides it wants to choke off shipments from that region, maybe block the Straits of Hormuz. What do you think would happen then?
Well, that is an option and one that some are suggesting could happen, but it seems unlikely simply because if they did that, they would be cutting off their nose to spite their face. We do see about 20 million barrels a day of crude and products passing through the strait, but that includes Iranian barrels as well. And so if they were to shut it, yes, prices would spike higher. It would only be a transient event, but it would also cut off their revenues because their barrels wouldn't be able to get out and get to their end users and they wouldn't receive payment for them.
So at the consumer level, it seems like this could be still bad, even though there is a certain insulation in when it comes to the amount or the quantity of supply. But what I'm trying to understand is, how is the price response bad for the Texas economy? Because it would seem to me that this would give producers, for example, a great opportunity to, say, start building back some of the losses that they've suffered, as they were expecting to, you know, see a return to $100 a barrel oil.
That's exactly right. So this rally is breathing some life into the U.S. oil producers, because it's giving them a great opportunity to hedge their future production. So what that means essentially is, as oil prices rise on the forward curve for both this year and next year, mm-hmm. they are able to hedge out their production at over $60 a barrel for this year and over $57 a barrel for next year. And so they're getting a guaranteed price for their oil. And so that is definitely going to give them a bit of a bump here.
The downside, it seems to me, would come in, say, purchases of oil. If the price rises to a certain point that makes it too expensive, say, for some consumers, that may be hard.
Yeah, that's right. You're going to see that price coming through at the pump. You know, gas stations will try and get ahead of the price rise. You know, we always see this typically, where you see prices shoot up like a rocket and float lower like a feather mm-hmm. when the prices come off. So the brunt will likely be felt at the pump in the coming days there, and even weeks if we do see some type of retaliation. But as you say, on the flip side of that, it is good for the Texas economy from the perspective the U.S. producers are going to be in a better position because of this rally.
Well, Matt Smith continues to follow the ups and downs of the oil markets as people try to come to terms with what might happen next between the United States and Iran. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, thanks so much, and we'll talk with you in another couple of Mondays.
Sounds good. Thanks, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro is endorsing Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren for president after ending his own campaign last week. In a video released this morning, the former housing secretary told Warren she's the most qualified to win the Democratic nomination and defeat President Donald Trump this fall.
You know, I started my campaign off, and we lived true to the idea that we want an America where everyone counts. It's the same vision that I see in you, in your campaign, in the America that you would help bring about.
Castro is planning to campaign alongside Warren tomorrow at a rally in New York. He ended his bid for the White House Thursday after struggling in the polls and failing to qualify for his party's last two primary debates. Later this month, communities across the country will take part in counting people dealing with homelessness in their area. KUT's Andrew Weber has more on where and when the annual headcounts will be in Texas.
So these counts are called point-in-time counts. They are an overnight census of folks who are sleeping outdoors and in shelters, and they're required to get federal money from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And in Texas, San Antonio, Dallas, and El Paso will be doing those counts overnight on January 23rd. In Austin, that will be the 25th. And in Houston, there will be a sheltered count on the 27th, and then a count of unsheltered folks on the 28th, 29th, and 30th.
Governor Greg Abbott has sparred recently with Austin officials over the city's ordinances loosening public camping restrictions. He's directed TxDOT to clear homeless encampments under highways in the capital since November. The Texas Comptroller reports sales tax revenue topped $3 billion last month, which is nearly 5% higher than December 2018. The growth in revenue was led by receipts from the construction, information services, and restaurant sectors. Jason Garrett is out after 9 seasons as the Dallas Cowboys head coach. KERA's Stephen Becker reports on Sunday's announcement.
Garrett compiled an 85-67 record since taking over for Wade Phillips midway through the 2010 season. In that time, he guided the team to just 2 playoff victories, including one last season. That raised expectations of an even deeper playoff run this year, hopes that were dashed when the Cowboys won just 8 games. Garrett is second only to Hall of Fame coach Tom Landry on the Cowboys' all-time list of games coached and victories. I'm Stephen Becker in Dallas.
And the Dallas Morning News reports former Green Bay coach Mike McCarthy came in Friday to interview for the head coaching job. Marvin Lewis, a former head coach with Cincinnati, interviewed Saturday. The public is invited to attend the burial of an unaccompanied veteran with no known next of kin today at the Central Texas Veterans Cemetery in Killeen. U.S. Navy veteran Mark Lancaster will be laid to rest with military honors at 11 a.m. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Ever since Texas lawmakers approved a measure legalizing hemp, low-level marijuana prosecutions have been plummeting in Texas. The hemp law was said to have sparked confusion regarding pot prosecution across the state. Prosecutors across Texas claimed it was too expensive or maybe not worth the time to try to determine whether a suspect substance was legal hemp or still illegal marijuana. With the new year, has anything changed? Jolie McCullough, criminal justice reporter for the Texas Tribune, has been reporting on this drop in marijuana prosecutions. Jolie, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Is there any confusion here, really? I mean, this doesn't seem like rocket science. One is a cousin of marijuana. The other is not real weed.
Well, the difference here is between a chemical variation and how much THC is in the plant, which is the part of the cannabis plant that gets you high. Mm-hmm. So if there's more than 0.3%, it's illegal marijuana, and if it's less, it's hemp. The problem that started is public crime labs, DPS, some of the county and city labs, can only determine if there is THC in a product, not how much there is. And that is expected to change here in the next month or so, but there hasn't been a way to distinguish between that. So some of the prosecutors and the Prosecutors Association has said, you know, this isn't going to hold up in court if something is hemp or marijuana because we haven't been able to distinguish it.
I'm sorry, you said something is expected to change here soon? What are you talking about?
Yeah, so DPS has been working on, and, you know, with the city and county crime labs and Sam Houston State University, they've been working on a new way and a new test to distinguish if something has more or less than 2% THC, which is going to be their cutoff since, you know, most plant marijuana material is at least 10% THC. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at a way, but I mean, again, marijuana is a case where, especially in misdemeanors, prosecutors didn't always send for testing in general. So mm-hmm. there's going to be a lot more testing if they're going to move forward with this. So it's just really, it has put like a complication in how to tell if something is marijuana. It's something that a lot of prosecutors are saying, you know, we can't tell just based on smell anymore like we used to be able to.
This doesn't seem to get at a question of, say, driving while under the influence, right? This is just talking about if you have some kind of substance that there's a question mark about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like possession cases, the most, you know, misdemeanor cases in marijuana are possession. So if you're pulled over, you're not necessarily exhibiting symptoms, you know, of something that would be more concerning that they're going to pull you in for. But, you know, if you have something in your glove box or whatever, it's a lot more difficult now as to what to do with that substance.
We spoke forgive me for interrupting you, but I want to ask what you make of this. We spoke mm-hmm. with an analyst last year who seemed to suggest that there's really no serious confusion here, that if you're in an area in Texas that tends to take a more permissive view of pot, you're going to say, oh, it's not worth our time. On the other hand, if you're in a more conservative part of Texas, you're going to try to enforce the law as written and you're going to pull out the stops. What are you finding?
Well, it seems like obviously the big city, urban, more Democrat DAs are kind of sure they haven't been wanting to pursue marijuana cases already. This is something that you might say is giving them a little bit of cover. But there are also counties like in the North Texas area, like Collin and Denton counties, which are more conservative suburbs of Dallas and Fort Worth. They also are saying, like, we're not pursuing this without a lab report and putting it on the police departments to pay for extra testing because they're having to stuff to private labs now, which cost, you know, hundreds of dollars more per case. And then they'll pursue them, but they don't want, you know, they want to make sure they're not prosecuting something that they shouldn't be.
Jolie, we're almost out of time, but you know, the purpose of this hemp law wasn't to decriminalize low-level marijuana offenses. So I wonder what happens going forward. Is the Texas legislature likely to react in the next session when it comes down to it?
There will be, I think, push from both sides. I think some people will be pushing, like, look, the sky hasn't fallen, and this is an effort that we need to now further, like, decriminalize marijuana. But then there will also be, you know, the intent of this bill was not to in any way decriminalize marijuana, so we need to push down on how we're going to enforce this and make sure that marijuana prosecution is still feasible.
A developing story indeed. Jolie McCullough continues to cover it as criminal justice reporter for the Texas Tribune. Jolie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Do red flag laws work? A real-world test. We'll be taking a look at it in just a few minutes as the Standard continues. Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Hi, my name is Tabir Badar. I'm known in my neck of the woods as the running man. I would say I run 16 to 20, you know, miles, I would say, altogether, yeah. But this is one of the things that I think is missing in our modern world, perhaps, this sort of visceral, this true experience of community. When I run on the highway and people see me over and over again, people respond to that. Sometimes I see people smiling, or maybe they're sort of having the same experience that I am when they see my face or something. There's a kind of a mirror neuron effect going on, maybe. My name is Tabir Badar. I was born in Pakistan, but I got to Texas as soon as I could. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard time. When Willie's guitar triggers having a tough go of it, there's a luthier in Austin he sends it to for loving attention and restoration. Now, you'd expect to find such a specialized craftsman in a place like Texas. What you might not expect to find is an expert in reviving a musical instrument more associated with powdered wigs than broad-brimmed Stinsons. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports on a plucky master.
Conductor Sir Thomas Beecham once quipped that the sound of a harpsichord is two skeletons copulating on a tin roof in a thunderstorm. But Beecham never heard one of Gerald Self's harpsichords.
There's nothing skeleton copulating. The skeletons might be doing something else.
Self is one of the leading harpsichord makers in Texas. Step inside his San Antonio home and you'll see why. It's filled wall to wall with harpsichords.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And there's one being worked on out there and one here for repair. So it's a bunch.
All of them here are self-made, with attention paid to exact historic detail. He's one of about 24 harpsichord master craftsmen in America.
Everything you see here is outright plagiarism. I have old pictures of old instruments, and I just did my absolute best to copycat.
Even down to the ornate paintings of flowers and insects that populate the inside of the case.
So I tried to figure out, how did they do that? And I did my best just to try to copy stroke by stroke.
The result is an instrument that doesn't just sound like it was plucked from another time, but it also looks like it.
Look how tiny it is. Oh my God.
Which is what the audience saw at a recent recital at Texas State University when afterwards they were invited onto the stage to get a close-up gander.
The biggest difference to me is the keys are wider on a piano. Kind of splatting, you have less room to kind of fit your finger on there.
Ezra Bartz is the coordinator for the piano program at Texas State and says he enjoys performing on a self harpsichord.
It's great. It's one of the best I've played on.
Self is self-taught about harpsichord making and its rich history.
Earliest type of harpsichord evolved alongside the violin. It was very light. It could be taken out and played on a table, or it could be played inside the case, you know, prop the lid up with a stick. And because of the construction, the tone is drained off rather quickly. This was the classic harpsichord for the 16th century, the 17th century. The opera orchestra grew up around this instrument.
Over the next couple of centuries, the harpsichord grew bigger, more complicated, and produced a more dark, majestic sound.
And this was basically the harpsichord at the time of the French Revolution. And most of the surviving French harpsichords were burned, because they represented the excesses of the Ancien Régime. You know, the new fangled instrument was the piano. So these guys were burned in piles and the piano took over.
But in the 1960s and 70s, there was a rebirth of interest in the harpsichord in the classical world and in pop music, with groups like the Beatles leading the way. It was at this time that Self discovered the harpsichord when he was at Austin College studying Baroque music.
As a performer, I had to have one of those. And there were two options. One you could buy for a tremendous amount of money, or you could build a very cheap harpsichord kit. And my dad and I built one. It wasn't very good, but it was usable.
A harpsichord was hip, and someone wanted to buy Self's first effort. And so he built another one and another. He's crafted over 100 since, getting better along the way. Self also mastered other instruments, those of the woodshop, the belt sander, the jigsaw, and drill press, so that each wooden piece can be fitted by hand. All of this takes quite a bit of time to finish one harpsichord.
Probably about 9 months.
The road to becoming a harpsichord master craftsman has been a life journey for the 72-year-old. Along the way, he's become a classical musician, a historian, a painter, a mechanic, a teacher.
But for me, the real joy is going to a concert and hearing it played.
Self says when one of his harpsichords is being used in a performance, he feels like he's the one on stage.
My nerves are, will the tuning hold?
Tuning a harpsichord is a bear. It takes a lot of time and patience. Slowly and methodically, each metal string is tested and adjusted. And harpsichords are very sensitive to changes in temperature and humidity.
For many years, I took instruments to Houston for concerts of Houston early music. I would move into the church around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It would be very nice, very peaceful, perfect tuning. The performers would come in and rehearse, perfect rehearsal. Then around 7 o'clock, you'd hear this as this massive air conditioner came on, and the temperature would start to drop 5 degrees, 10 degrees, and then the stage lights, whoong, come on, these big heat lamps on the instrument.
So with the combination of the cold air and the heat lamps, the tuning wanders off.
And I'm sitting in the audience hearing octaves that are not in tune, going, oh,
please, please. That's the hardest part.
Right now, we're in the twilight of the modern harpsichord revival. To meet that explosion of interest in the 60s and 70s, Self and others devoted to harpsichord making managed to reclaim what was then an almost lost art. And now the question is, who will carry that flame into the future? The problem is, there's no longer a major demand for new harpsichords.
Not as much I'd like to buy a harpsichord as I would like. A lot of Can You Fix Mine.
What keeps Self going is his love for the early music, and being able to have it enjoyed the way that the old classical composers intended. That's why, when it's Baroque, Gerald Self can fix it. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. After last year's mass shootings in El Paso and Odessa, the topic of whether Texas should have red flag laws has resurfaced again here. That's the name for any type of measure that allows law enforcement and family members to petition a court to remove someone's firearms out of a danger to themselves or to others. Although President Trump has expressed support for such laws, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has said it's something the Texas legislature should take a closer look at if it's going to be decided. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has said that such a measure would never be passed by the Texas Senate, however. But D.C. and 17 other states do have them, including Oregon. As part of the ongoing Guns in America series, Oregon Public Radio's Jonathan Levinson explores the impact there. And a warning to listeners, this story mentions suicide.
And you look at this guy and you think, he wants to commit suicide?
Yeah, right.
No, I don't
right.
think so.
Diane is talking about her son, Josh. She's in the kitchen doing a jigsaw puzzle with her sister, Irene. In the fall of 2017, Josh's girlfriend broke up with him, and it hit him hard. He became depressed and started drinking. But he was good at hiding his depression from others.
So when he'd leave, my mom goes, he's doing great. And it's like, no, he's not. He's so good at putting on that face. And
Guns in America isn't using Josh or his family's last name to protect his privacy. In February 2018, Josh shot himself in the leg. On the way to the hospital, he told his mom he had tried to kill himself.
And then it just seemed like all of a sudden he spiraled down bad.
Eventually, Diane would use Oregon's newly created extreme risk protection orders to have her son's firearms removed. The laws are commonly known by the acronym ERPO, or as red flag laws. Oregon's version allows immediate family, cohabitants, or law enforcement to ask a judge to prohibit a person from owning or buying a firearm for 1 year. The law went into effect on January 1st, 2018. Guns in America has reviewed all 166 petitions filed in the state through October 31st, 2019. They paint a picture of people in extraordinary crisis.
Oh, man, I about tore my heart out. Felt like he hated me.
For the couple of months after Josh shot himself, he was in and out of the hospital. But since he hid his depression and suicidal thoughts from doctors, they were limited in what they could do.
But he definitely talked about he was depressed, and he would say, I want to die.
She followed the doctor's advice and tried to take his guns from him, but he refused.
And I had tried at one point, and he got my face and said, get the blank out of here.
Finally, in April 2018, a police officer on a wellness check at their home told Diane about the new extreme risk protection orders. Of the 166 petitions filed in Oregon since the law took effect, more than two-thirds were for people at risk of suicide. And nearly a quarter of the ERPO petitions were related to domestic violence. Currently, 17 states plus the District of Columbia have extreme risk protection orders. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum told Oregon Public Broadcasting in an August interview that Oregon's law hasn't been widely promoted.
It is not being widely used. It is not widely known about.
Of Oregon's 36 counties, 11 haven't issued a single ERPO, and 7 have issued just one. Part of that may be a function of awareness for the new law, but it may also be political.
I believe that if there's a preconceived notion that these are not appropriate in our county, it's not going to occur to any law enforcement to try to process them.
Rachel Espy is executive director of the SAFE Project, a domestic violence advocacy program in Coos County, Oregon.
So I think that it's more of a culture here in Coos County that everyone has a right to a firearm because of our Second Amendment rights.
She supports the Second Amendment, but says not everyone has a right to a firearm. While Oregon's law may not have been fully embraced, law enforcement officials in some states have said they won't enforce an ERPO law. Detective Lucas Franks with the Washington County Sheriff's Office in Oregon has been using them for almost 2 years.
It's certainly not the answer to all the problems, but it can be a useful tool.
He says before, there were times when he would just have to accept that a risk would be left unaddressed.
That void that we may not have been able to resolve in the past, the ERPO potentially helps with that.
Diane said getting the ERPO for her son Josh was a wake-up call for him.
I think it really shocked him what I did, and I think that it really gave him some reality.
Soon after the order was in place, Josh got sober. His mom said he started going to Alcoholics Anonymous and seeing a therapist.
I don't know that he'll ever come to me and say thank you for all you did, but that's okay.
She says that is part of being a parent. For Guns in America, I'm Jonathan Levinson.
Guns in America and KERA are spending 2 years reporting the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsinamerica.org. And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us now in the studio, it's a social media editor, Wells Dunbar. No, it's not. No, I'm afraid he's away today. You look like Michael Marks.
I am. Yep, Wells got I think Wells got bit by the cedar fever bug.
I'll tell you, who hasn't? I mean, the trees are alive with the sound of they're yellow, and it's just unbelievable.
It is exploding
in this dust.
Truly, the time of year where you surf Zillow for other parts of the country and see if there's a non-cedar filter that you can apply.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about the other thing that is big item taking up space in Texans' heads, David. Mm-hmm. That's football.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start with the actual football news first. A big weekend for both of Texas's NFL teams for very different reasons. Mm-hmm. The positive here on the field, Houston Texans advancing to the second round of the NFL playoffs.
How about that, huh?
Texans beat the Buffalo Bills in overtime Saturday. They will advance to the second round, where they get the privilege of playing the Kansas City Chiefs to take another step toward the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Tall task. Right now, Chiefs favored to win by more than 9 points. Twitter user Kinonis in Houston chooses not to prognosticate about the upcoming game. He says, I'm not going to say if the Texans will win or lose because I know this team. They always get our hopes up. Probably the safe route there. Hope for the best, expect the worst.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, that team up Interstate 45, they had quite a weekend
They ever. So within 24 hours mm-hmm. of firing their head coach, already the rumors started circulating that they've hired somebody new.
That's exactly what happened. The Dallas Cowboys parted ways with their longtime head coach, Jason Garrett. Wasn't explicitly fired. The team just let his contract run out. He's no longer under the employ.
Mm-hmm.
After disappointing 8-8 season, Jerry Jones thought it was time for Garrett to go. Many Cowboys fans did too.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremiah Avery and Garland, not Garrett, writes, got to admit, I liked Garrett, wanted him to win just as bad as Jerry Jones did. That being said, he just wasn't good enough. Cowboys fans will see if Mike McCarthy is good enough.
Mike McCarthy.
Reportedly the new head honcho in Dallas. He last coached in Green Bay. Won 61% of his games and a Super Bowl to boot.
Hmm.
Some folks like Curtis Simpson, though, concerned with how fast this happened, as you alluded to. He tweets in part, Mike McCarthy is a good pick. I think I'm more concerned that it feels like the Cowboys didn't examine every option and just impulse bought, like it was a TV or something.
Yeah, well, I got to think that Jones was probably considering his options for some time, no?
You would have to think so. I mean, I feel if you're an NFL owner, you probably have a short list of guys who you would go to just in case something went awry. Mike McCarthy was obviously high on the list. He spent the night at the Jones family house
the other night.
Oh, you know.
So this has not yet been confirmed by the team.
I think it's been confirmed by Mike McCarthy.
I see.
So I think it's official.
Yeah. Well, we'd love to hear what's making news in your part of Texas. As always, you can tweet us at Texas Standard. And, of course, we're going to be looking for your comments as the day goes on. You can keep up with the news at texasstandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown wishing you a wonderful Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.